Welcome to the Everything Financial Radio program. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. I am here every week at this time. This is where we talk about what's going on in the economy and how it affects you and your money. On this week's program, I'll be interviewing our returning special guest expert, Mr. Jim Babka. Jim will be talking to us about his new Zero Aggression project. Jim is the president of Downsize DC and the Downsize DC Foundation. So always a pleasure to talk with him. Also on today's program, as it relates to what's going on in the economy, the Federal Reserve this past week decided to leave interest rates unchanged, just as I predicted they would. In fact, I will tell you that I don't believe we're going to see interest rates go up at all this year. I'll tell you why in the second segment of today's program. And in the last segment of today's program, I'll be talking about stocks, and I'm going to discuss with you seven indicators that you should pay attention to as it relates to the stock market. If you have money in stocks or stock mutual funds, you'll want to stay tuned and listen to the fourth segment of today's program, because I'll be sharing with you what I believe are warning signs being flashed by not just one indicator, but seven indicators. So we'll talk about those indicators and what you might think about doing in your own portfolio as well. So a lot to talk about today. Again, glad you tuned in. Before I bring up my interview with Mr. Jim Babka, let me remind you that we do have a new retirement rules class coming up on July 25th. That will be our last class of the summer. It'll be held at the downtown campus of Western Michigan University. It's Saturday, July 25. It's held from 9 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. All the details are posted at newretirementrules.com. The website, again, newretirementrules.com. I'm pleased to have on the Everything Financial Radio program returning guest, Mr. Jim Babka. Always a pleasure to have Jim on the program. For those of you that are new listeners to the program, Jim is a writer and an activist. He does some radio. He's president of the Downsize DC Foundation and DownsizeDC.org, and he is the co-creator of the Zero Aggression Project. Jim, welcome back to the program.
It's great to be back.
Well, Jim, let's talk for our listeners that are maybe not familiar with Downsize DC and the Downsize DC Foundation. Talk about your mission. What is it that you are looking to accomplish?
Well, when people visit DownsizeDC.org, they should be struck by two things. First, we have provided information on a variety of issues so that they can easily communicate with their representative and two senators in Congress. We provide a tool called the Educate the Powerful system, where people can put their basic contact information in. The system tells them who their representative and two senators are, and then delivers a letter to each of those respective offices, but simultaneously, in such a way that that office knows that it's hearing from a constituent. Each day, we alert over 24,000 people as to what Congress is up to. We give them a sample letter with which to work via our newsletter. And people can sign up for the newsletter, or they can use the system to send a letter on a variety of issues. Everybody will find something they like at DownsizeDC.org. The other thing that we're known for over there is our Downsize DC agenda. These are three bills that we have written from scratch. They're designed to change the process to actually downsize DC. These three bills are the Read the Bills Act, the Write the Laws Act, and the One Subject at a Time Act. The One Subject at a Time Act's easiest to explain because it says there's a every bill has to have a simple title limited to just one topic. The Write the Laws Act deals with separation of powers, which has largely been lost. It suggests that Article 1 only gave Congress the ability to write laws. They did not give that power to unelected bureaucrats at the EPA or the FDA or the FEC, et cetera. And we say that all legislation, all laws binding on you and me, as individual citizens in this country, must be passed through the People's Congress. They must be passed by the House and the Senate, not by unelected bureaucrats. That's the Write the Laws Act. The Read the Bills Act is probably the one we're best known for. That one says that Congress must read their bills. If you want to cast a yes vote to spend more money to pass a new law, you first have to sign an affidavit saying that you have either read the bill for yourself in its entirety, or you have sat through a word-for-word, start-to-finish reading of the bill. We've put that in there because we want the bills to be shorter, and we want them to be fewer. We are downsized DC after all, and we think the mind will procure what the hiney will endure. If they have to sit through long bills, they'll stop passing so many of them. But we also said that you need to be able to read the bill, Dennis. Your audience that's listening right now needs to be able to read the bill. I need to be able to read the bill over at Downsize DC to alert our people. And that means that the bill should be posted for 7 days online for the public to read before the final vote is cast. And in all three of these cases, these are not just simply a little tiny rule where we wish and hope that Congress will actually abide by its own rules. We know that Congress is perhaps the most anarchic institution in the country. Each of these are actually turned into a law by virtue of the fact that if Congress does not follow the procedures spelled out and you find yourself in the dock, you're on trial for something that they passed, a tax you didn't pay, a law that you violated, you could present the evidence to the judge that the procedure was not followed, and the judge should dismiss the case with impunity. In other words, they can't bring the charge back up against you again. So if they want to waste their time passing laws in ways that don't conform to the procedures spelled out in these bills, let them do that. We think that we can far better protect the people and downsize D.C. with these three bills as part of the approach.
Well, Jim, talk about the Zero Aggression Project. Let the listeners know what that is.
Well, the Zero Aggression Project is a separate educational effort that we do through our Downsize D.C. Foundation. The Zero Aggression Project is brand new. We just launched it June 1, and in fact, not even all of the parts of the website are available yet. They will be coming online, various parts of it, as the over the course of the next 2 months. And so we're, you know, many of those parts are done. They're just sitting behind walls right now. The Zero Aggression Project is an attempt to get a moral, philosophical discussion started on something called the Zero Aggression Principle. The Zero Aggression Principle basically says that it is wrong to initiate coercive force against others, and it's still wrong if you delegate that power to a politician. And if you look at what our government does, everything that they do is backed by force. It's not a persuasion enterprise. That's not their goal. The reason we turn to the state is because we expect them to use their bullying power in some way. They raise the funds through extortion. And then they turn around and spend those funds, even for some noble cause, but they still choose to spend those funds. And in spending those funds, they frequently take away choices that you would have made otherwise, prohibit you from doing things that would, you know, that are part of your liberty or your happiness, some things that might even save your life in the case of, say, medicines, for example. And we're saying that all that force needs to stop, and we need to be aware that that's what the transaction is, that that is how the state works. That is what politicians are proposing when they stand up and offer this program or that. And the reason we want to have this kind of discussion as opposed to the typical political discussion is because we want to change how people respond to this information. You know, Dennis, when people have discussions about politics, and I'm using scare quotes, which don't work very well on radio, but when they want to have a political discussion, they do so using their partisan hymn book. They know what their favorite talk show host says. They know what their favorite cable TV network says. They know what their favorite publications or websites say. And they know how to spout those words. But that's all surface. And if you were going to try to respond and try to help people through that, you would have to deal with each issue one at a time. And you would have to deal with the fact that they were very entrenched in their partisan in their tribal identification, and you would be spending your time having to just constantly study all these issues in depth, and the information on it would constantly update and shift and change, and you would have to keep on top of all these different policy studies and debate points. We're saying that there's one simple place we can go, the moral philosophy underlying all of this. Is it okay for me to point a gun at you and require you to do X or Y? If that's not okay, and most people don't do this in their day-to-day living. They practice or live by the golden rule in their personal dealings. When they are around strangers, they follow something I might call the silver rule. They leave each other alone. We walk down the street with no fear that we're going to get punched in the mouth or robbed or raped or stolen from. Some people even forget to lock their doors when they leave home and don't worry about it. And we can only do this because we have an expectation that this is how we behave in civil society. But somehow or other, this changes when we get into politics and we're at each other's throats. And the difference between partisan debates and this debate is you only need to really understand this principle, and you only need to really talk about this principle. Now, there's things to extrapolate from it, but this is the core idea. It's a much simpler discussion to have, and by the way, it's a much different conversation to have because people don't have a favored talk show host that's doing moral philosophy. They don't have a favored cable TV channel that's explaining these things in a moral philosophical way. And so at the end of the day, they're more open or willing to consider the ideas, and it creates an entirely different kind of conversation. And best of all, when you're all done, if they agree with this principle, it applies to everything.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. It's amazing how fast a segment goes with Mr. Jim Babka. He's the co-creator of the Zero Aggression Project and also president of Downsize DC. I'll continue my conversation with him when Everything Financial Radio returns. Stay with us. This is Everything Financial Radio. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. Glad you decided to listen in today. You know, the big news this past week was that the Federal Reserve policymakers last Wednesday decided they would not raise interest rates. They would keep the short-term interest rate near zero, which is exactly as I predicted. In fact, I will go on record as stating that the Federal Reserve will not raise interest rates anytime this year. I could be wrong, but I'll give you some reasons why I believe interest rates will not go up. Now, many folks I find are unfamiliar with, or at the very least confused about, who the Federal Reserve is and what does the Federal Reserve do. Well, the Federal Reserve is a private group of bankers. The Federal Reserve is not a government agency. In fact, back in 1913, President Woodrow Wilson signed into law an act that made the Federal Reserve in control of monetary policy. So for the last almost 102 years, it'll be 102 years this December, the Federal Reserve, this private group of bankers, has been setting monetary policy. Now, every now and then, the chair of the Federal Reserve, presently that chair is Janet Yellen, shows up in front of Congress and answers questions. So Congress is charged with making the Fed accountable, but the Fed is a private group of bankers. Now, there was an article in the LA Times that talked about the announcement that the Fed would keep interest rates at zero. And I'll give you just a bit from that article. Fed officials sharply downgraded their economic forecast for this year. They projected the economy would grow between 1.8 and 2% this year, well below the range of 2.3% to 2.7% in its last forecast in March. I will go on record as saying that I believe the United States is in a recession currently, meaning I believe that once the numbers are adjusted, we're actually in a time of economic contraction. Now, back to the LA Times article, if they're correct, referring again to the slower growth rate, annual growth would be the worst since 2011. It would be far from the breakout performance some economists had hoped for this year. In a statement after its two-day policymaking meeting, Fed officials said that the economy had been expanding moderately after having improved little during the first quarter. The Fed officials forecast the unemployment rate, which was 5.5% in May, would drop to no lower than 5.2% by the end of the year. In March, they forecast the jobless rate would drop to as low as 5% this year. Now, if you've been a longtime listener to Everything Financial Radio, you know we've talked about the fact that much of the economic data that's reported has been manipulated, or at the very least, the methodology used to calculate these this economic data has changed significantly. So the official unemployment rate really, in my view, is not that dependable. The labor force participation rate is a much more accurate measure as to the health of the economy relating to employment, and the labor force participation rate is very, very low. And annual inflation is expected to be between 0.6 and 0.8% this year, the same as was forecast in March, and that's well below the Fed's 2% target. Well, I believe the Fed won't raise interest rates simply because I don't believe that they can. Assuming interest rates don't go up, that will continue to punish savers. It will continue to be difficult, if not impossible, to invest your nest egg in conservative, interest-yielding type investments and get a living wage, if you will. There was an article, an op-ed piece, actually, that was published in Forbes magazine the end of last year by a gentleman by the name of Mark Hendrickson. And the article was titled, "The Fed Painted Into a Corner," and it describes my sentiments exactly. I'll give you a bit from Mr. Hendrickson's piece. Speculation abounds as to when the Federal Reserve will begin to raise interest rates. Decades ago, this would have been called the $64 million question, but today trillions rather than millions of dollars are at stake. With the warning that I have neither a crystal ball nor connections to anyone inside the Fed, it seems to me most unlikely that the Fed will raise interest rates in 2015. In a statement that received huge publicity, the Federal Open Market Committee stated that it can be patient in beginning to normalize the stance of monetary policy. Let me repeat that. The Fed statement was that it can be patient in beginning to normalize the stance of monetary policy. Now, that is a bit of an understatement if you think about it, because interest rates haven't really changed since 2006, going on 9 years or so. So when you say patient, I don't know what patient really means. It seems to me that that length of time is already very patient. What's more interesting about that statement is the term normalize. It's an admission that the policy in recent years has been anything but normal. Interest rates have not been normal. Credit markets have not been normal. The Fed's massive interventions or printing of money to buy government debt and mortgage-backed securities has not been normal. And because of that, all that activity not being normal, I believe that I don't think we'll see things normalize for quite a period of time moving ahead. And there's a couple reasons for that. Even though the money printing or quantitative easing is over for the time being, federal deficits are lower than they were. They're still huge, but they're lower than they were at the time the quantitative easing or money printing policy was launched. But there's a couple factors that made me think the Fed is painted into a corner. Fact number one, the United States has more than $18 trillion in official debt, about $18.26 trillion. And most of this debt is financed over the short term. What that means is that this is a short-term loan, and if interest rates were to go up, the interest that the U.S. government would pay on their outstanding debt, since most of it is financed over the short term, would go up much more quickly, which would put a huge crunch on the federal budget and likely lead to a huge political showdown or potentially even worse. Now, there's another factor, and I'm going to go back to the article published by Mr. Hendrickson and give you just a bit from that article. He said, another factor, and again referring to why the Fed will likely not raise rates, is the precarious financial situation of most of the rest of the world. A friend of mine, who's a very cagey retired bond trader, recently pointed out that emerging markets, the most vulnerable and fragile markets in the world, have borrowed over $3 trillion U.S. dollars from banks and have issued almost another $3 trillion in U.S. dollar-denominated bonds at very low interest rates. Should domestic interest rates rise, and along with interest rates, the exchange rate of the buck, emerging market paper would be devastated, triggering a chain reaction that would convulse markets around the world. Yes, easy money policies, I believe, also tend to prop up markets. And there are a number of things that make me believe that this stock market, although it could continue to go up for a period of time, there is a lot of signals that you should be aware of. If you have money in stocks or stock mutual funds, I'll be talking about that when Everything Financial Radio continues. First, let me remind you of a couple of educational resources that we have available. We have our last new retirement rules class of the summer coming up on Saturday, July 25. That class will be held at the downtown campus of Western Michigan University. If you'd like to get more information, simply visit the website newretirementrules.com. And we also have a couple Social Security maximization workshops coming up, July 7 at Watermark Country Club and July 16 at Sunnybrook Country Club. Those meetings begin at 6 and conclude with a complimentary dinner at 7:30. They fill up quickly. If you'd like to get more information, visit the website socialsecuritydinner.com. I'll be back after these words.
Give me your money. Just give me money. Monday, Monday, Monday. Always Sunday. In the rich man's world.
This is the Everything Financial Radio program. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. I have the distinct pleasure of chatting on today's program with the co-creator of the Zero Aggression Project, Mr. Jim Babka. Jim also serves as president of the Downsize DC Foundation, as well as Downsize DC. You can get more information on Downsize DC at downsizedc.org. Jim, we were talking in the last segment about the Zero Aggression Principle. So talk about what the Zero Aggression Project is going to accomplish.
I would say that the number one thing for us, and maybe I'll make this the top two things, is that we want to start a dialogue that softens opposition to our position and finds and activates people who already agree with us. The simple math here is if you believe that the federal government or your state government are doing too much, if you believe that they're spending too much of your money, that they're engaging in too many wars, that they're regulating you in ways that are unacceptable, whatever it is, then you're going to basically agree with our approach, at least to some degree. And you're certainly going to agree with our direction. And the problem for us has been is there's not enough of us who believe strongly that the state does way too much. We are outnumbered. We are outranked. And this is the problem that comes up again and again. If there were more of us, there would be more money. There would be more candidates. There would be more activists. There would be more of us just simply standing up and objecting to the things that are happening and maybe even proposing better ways of doing things through voluntary engagement with one another. And so our goal is really to find those people and to activate those people. Our goal is to soften resistance and even persuade people over to our position so at the end of the day, there are more of us.
So, Jim, when you talk, it's just those positions, I think, are positions that resonate certainly with most of our listeners. And yet, when you look at the number of folks that are dependent upon government, dependency, many people would argue, makes people apathetic as to what actually happens as long as they get what's coming to them. And I could probably put quotation marks around that coming to them. What are the chances that we can actually get some meaningful change?
Well, there's a number of different things, ways that meaningful change can come about, and it just kind of depends on the area. Let me give you an example that may or may not appeal to some members of your audience, but I happen to believe that the war on drugs is a tremendous failure. And a lot of these stories that we're seeing now about police violence and issues with authority have to do with the fact that there's a general disrespect for the law. And the disrespect from the law stems from the fact that the law is doing things that it is not empowered to do. It's not just drug prohibition, but the outgrowth of this, one of them has been asset forfeiture laws. So police departments, sheriff's departments, highway patrols, and federal government agencies are funding some of their efforts by confiscating property from citizens. Oftentimes, people who just happen to have cash on them or some other possession. They're just taking this stuff and declaring the property guilty without, because it's presumed guilty until it can be proven innocent. I don't know how you examine a property and cross-examine such a property, allow it to be defended. I don't understand how all that stuff works, but this is how asset forfeiture is going in this country. And we have a high rate of imprisonment, people coming out of prison for nonviolent drug offenses who cannot get a job. And so we see there's social problems, there's problems with authority in the police department, there's problems with people's property being taken. And most people will tell you at the end of the day that they don't believe that prohibition works, that the drug war has been successful. Do we have to go to Washington to change things? Well, many states have found that through ballot initiative and referenda, they've been able to change the law in their state. So they didn't have to go to Washington to get it done. They didn't have to go to their state to get it done. They were able to make a dramatic improvement at home using a tool that was available to them. But that tool is only available in 23 states. What if there was a tool that you, as just a single individual who now understands with a firm moral conviction that cannot be moved, that there's a principle at stake here, that this zero aggression principle matters so much that if you're on a jury, you'll hang a jury if that's what it takes when someone comes before you charged with a nonviolent drug offense. How long would prosecutors continue to pursue these cases if they knew that a jury is likely to be hung by just one out of 12 members of the population who happen to have been called for jury duty? So change can come in a lot of different forms, and it can even come when there's only one of us. But what is required for that person to stand up in that jury room is a firm moral conviction, and that's why we have to have a moral philosophical argument.
Jim, let's talk about some of the tools now that your organization have developed. Explain what people will find on the website.
Yeah, let me start with the one that we actually have available now. There's more coming, but I just want to start today, Dennis, with the one that we have available now. And that is that there are going to be people who think that there are exceptions to the zero aggression principle. They're going to have an issue that they think, well, I agree with you on, you know, these 8 or 9 out of 10 things, but there's this one over here that, you know, it's an exception. We can't follow zero aggression principle. That would be unrealistic. And it could be for whatever reason. They could have moral, they could still have a remaining moral objection. They could have a philosophical objection. They could have a pragmatic objection. They may just have a fear-based objection. Whatever that objection is, we want to begin to address that issue specifically. So we have created something we call polling campaigns. These are surveys that people take. They're made up of multiple panels designed to answer the questions that are most on people's minds. And what we're doing within this tool that is so unique that should be valuable to anyone who is in general agreement with our cause is that for the very first time, we are taking in answers and measuring people's movement either for, and here's the important part, or away from our position. We're not threatened by the fact that our arguments may actually have the reverse effect. We can learn from that. Obviously, our goal is to bring in as many people who are moving towards our position as possible. And so there's a vote, there's a slider at the bottom of every one of these panels after we've presented our case. And these are all very short panels for the most part. People get the basic argument, find out a couple of facts, and when they're done with that material, they can vote. They can take a position, then move on to the next panel. At any point they want, they can skip to any other questions so they can find the objection or the portion of the objection that interests them the most, get their most important question about that about this particular exception answered. And we've posted an example for people to see how this works and to interact with themselves. Our very first polling campaign is the drug prohibition campaign. As I'm talking to you right now, we are just a couple of days away from launching one on Social Security. So people will be able to go in and they'll be able to digest this information. And we, of course, start with the zero aggression principle. And then we begin to apply the principle of force, show how it works, and ask if you would want to be the person carrying out that force, personalize it, emotionalize it, and focus on the morality of it. And then we go, our last question in the opening section is what we call our check writing question, which is, would you pay for it? If you, Dennis, how many programs that we have going on that maybe people are for in general when they're out there voting the population, but if they had to sit down and write a check for it every month, like they, you know, like a membership do, yeah, I want more regulation of drugs. Yes, I want more regulation of corporations. Yes, I want more, I want higher taxes, you know, whatever. They'd have to sit down and write a check. I want more doors kicked in by the DEA. They'd have to write a check for those services. Would they do it? And from there, we get into what are more of the pragmatic arguments that are typical in these kind of discussions, but we do it in a different frame. We keep increasing the cost of the program. We keep showing the negative side effects of the choice to use force. And then we ask the question again if they still want to pay for it. So we're trying to have a very different type of conversation here. The tool's there to facilitate that conversation. You can share it with friends. You can share individual panels, individual portions of these arguments with friends. So it will become a resource library as well. But at the end of the day, the thing that I'm most excited about is that we actually are measuring our arguments and the effect that they're having. And so I would encourage people to come to the Zero Aggression Project. They can just look at the top navigation tool there and click on the appropriate button, which is "What do you think?" And then they will see the list of any campaigns that we have available. And by the time this broadcasts, I believe there'll be two of them, drug prohibition and Social Security, to get the ball rolling.
And Jim, clarify the web address for our listeners, please.
Yes, it's zeroaggressionproject.org.
Okay, and I encourage the listeners to check it out. Jim, let me just ask from a developmental perspective, what gave you, as one of the co-creators of the Zero Aggression Project, the idea to invest all this time and all these resources in the project?
Well, you know, we've noticed that there's been a change in the dynamic about how these issues are discussed and viewed compared to when I first started. I've been full-time in some form of activism since the late 90s, and I've been full-time employed as a CEO in these kind of efforts since 2001. And so, I was just being out there entrepreneurially trying a number of different things. In 2004, we launched Downsize DC. And about 2007 time frame, when Ron Paul got into the presidential race, a different type of dialogue began to emerge on a number of different issues. And the people who were attracted, who had not paid any attention to politics before, that got involved, kept studying the issues. What was motivating Ron Paul's campaign? What was his philosophy? And as they began to dig deeper and deeper into this, they got exposed to sources and ideas that were quite a bit different. And they went even further than simply being a mere voter. They started embracing a viewpoint of the world that largely sees people as equals, largely believes that violence is not the very first resort to solving a problem. And they believe in this, therefore, in this zero aggression principle. And so, but we did notice, as we were approaching this, that they weren't using it when they were having conversations with people. They weren't leading with it. And we began to ask ourselves why. I know we're short on time, so I'm not going to get into it, but there are two innovations that we have brought to this unique argument about how it should be presented, the type of objection you're going to face, and the responses that should be provided to it. They deal with the question of anarchy, and they deal with the question of empathy. And as time goes by, people will see how we're dealing with that. But everything that we're doing is constructed on bringing these two innovations to the table and then encouraging people who believe in this value to begin actually leading with it, to share it openly. And to do so with confidence. And so we felt that the time was right for this and that we had something new to bring to the table and that we could also provide a set of tools that would make people even more effective at it. So we set to work to get this done. It was a tool that Perry Willis, my partner, and I both felt we wanted. Members of our team said, gee, it would be great if we had that. And we just looked in the mirror and said, let's get it done.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. The website is zeroaggressionproject.org. You can also go to downsizedc.org to learn more about the work that Jim does. Jim, appreciate you being on the program today. Love to have you back.
I always look forward to it, Dennis. Thank you.
Thank you. And Everything Financial Radio returns after these words. Stay with us. Welcome back to Everything Financial Radio. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. Glad you decided to listen in today. In this segment, I want to talk a bit about the United States stock market. Stocks are entering their seventh year of a bull market. In fact, March marked the six-year anniversary of the market bottom. Since that time, markets are up significantly. In fact, the NASDAQ now is back over 5,000, the first time that's happened in 15 years. And the question we want to investigate in this segment, the question we want to explore is this bull market going to continue? Well, we can look at indicators and look at what's happened historically. And of course, just because something's happened historically doesn't mean it will happen again. But it's very interesting to take a look at indicators, and indicators seem to tell us that investors today are very, very bullish. Newsletter writers are very, very bullish. These are investment newsletter writers are very, very bullish. And since the crowd is usually wrong, often this extreme bullishness occurs at or near a market peak. Now, in this segment, I want to walk you through just a few of these indicators, but more importantly, I'll give you some ideas that you might consider using to potentially protect yourself if the market is indeed at a top. The first indicator that I want to talk about is an indicator called the Investors Intelligence Bulls to Bears Ratio. This indicator basically tells us what financial newsletter writers are advising their readers. Now, if you take a look at this indicator and go back and look at it really since the 60s, only really a couple times has the indicator been more bullish than it is today, and it is more bullish than it has been at any time in the last 30 years. If you look at the numbers, basically any number over 75 is considered to be very bullish. Any number below about 40 is considered to be very bearish. Well, at the market bottom, for example, in March of 2009, this bulls to bears ratio was actually about 35. When you look at the bear market of 73 and see the bottom that occurred in about 75, this indicator was at about 33. So at market bottoms, this is a pretty accurate predictor. And then at market tops, if you take a look, for example, at where this indicator was at the market top in 1999, it was about 65. At the market top in 2000, this indicator was at about 70. And today, this ratio is at 80. It hasn't been this high in 30 years. So what this tells us is the overwhelming majority of investment newsletter writers are bullish. And again, the crowd is typically wrong according to what we see historically. In fact, these newsletter writers are 82% of them are bullish on U.S. stocks and only 18% are bearish. Now, the second indicator I want to talk about is an indicator that tracks the price of the 25 cheapest stocks in the S&P 500. So this would be the 20th percentile. There's 500 stocks that make up the S&P 500. We're looking at the cheapest 20. So if we take a look at where this level is and take a look at the cheapest stocks, and again, we use numbers for a reference point, this tool has given a pretty accurate buy or sell signal depending on the number value of these cheapest 20 stocks. Buying opportunities have traditionally taken place when the indicator is below 6. In 2009, at the market bottom, this indicator was at 4. The market bottom in 2002, this indicator was at about 4.5. Conversely, a sell signal often occurs when it is at 17 or higher. If you go back to 1999, this indicator was at about 22 prior to the market correction. In 2007, 2008, it was at about 17. Today, it's at 20, and it's been over 20 for several months. So this is the highest number, the highest overbought signal in its history, or close to the highest overbought signal. It's almost where it was at the market correction that began at the end of the tech stock bubble back in 1999. The third indicator that I want to talk about is the number of IPOs or initial public offerings that are unprofitable. This is a pretty interesting indicator and a pretty valuable indicator to look at, in my opinion, because as markets heat up, more and more companies make an initial public offering. In fact, this past week, Fitbit made a public offering that was successful. Well, the more public offerings that are made, the more IPOs that are made, the more of them that will tend to be unprofitable. And if you look at the percent of unprofitable initial public offerings and look at where it was again at prior market peaks, in 1999, 76% of initial public offerings were unprofitable. And you have to think about what was happening at that time. This was the end of the tech stock bubble. Many of these tech stock companies, these dot-com companies, didn't even have any earnings, and yet they went public anyway. In 2007, near the market peak, 65% of initial public offerings were unprofitable. Today, we have surpassed the percentage of initial public offerings that are unprofitable that existed back in 1999. In 1999, 76% of initial public offerings, as we've already stated, were unprofitable. Today, 78%. Then we take a look at price-to-sales ratios of stocks. We look at the price of a company's stock, and we look at the company's sales. And if you take a look at this number again, back in 1999, look at the number in 2007, you see that in 2007, the price-to-sales ratio was even higher than it was in 1999, and today it is even significantly higher than it was in 2007. So this reinforces the notion that the stock market is priced at an excessive level. Some would even argue an outrageous level. Here's another indicator that, if you think about it, makes sense, but it's something that you probably wouldn't immediately think of as an indicator that you wanted to use to determine the valuation level of the stock market. When you look at quantitative easing, when you look at the money printing that's occurred, many markets, as a result, have become overbought. They've become inflated. Asset price bubbles exist. We believe this exists in the stock market, but it also exists in the art market. When you look at art auctions, which typically are more prevalent in the spring, purchases of fine art at the spring art auctions this past year reached the largest dollar amount in recorded history. Historically speaking, the correlation between the art and stock markets is very high, and what it tends to indicate is there's excessive speculation in the system. So if you just take a look at May of 1999, there were 290 million dollars, $290 million of art sold. 2007 was 531, today 585. And then finally, even though the market has continued to go higher, when you take a look at the number of stocks making new highs and compare the number of new stocks making new lows, you get something else that makes us think that the market may be at or near a top. When markets are reaching new highs, we want a number of stocks to also be making new highs. It tends to indicate that the market is moving lockstep, that there's a lot of participation as the market moves higher. That is not the case today. The number of new highs compared to new lows has been declining since 2013. So for about 2 years now, we have seen the number of new highs continue to drop off as compared to new lows, which tells us there may not be enough participation in the market as well. Now, in our new retirement rules class, we talk about strategies you might consider to protect yourself. We talk about alternate strategies that may allow you to get a reasonable rate of return without participating in a market decline. I'd like to invite you to learn more by visiting the website, newretirementrules.com. The website, again, is newretirementrules.com. Our last class of the summer is coming up on July 25. You can get more information at the website, newretirementrules.com, or you can get more information there as well. Also, we have another educational resource that I want to make you aware of. We have our Social Security maximization seminars that we do. We've got a couple coming up in July. If you'd like more information, visit socialsecuritydinner.com. The website, again, is socialsecuritydinner.com. You'll see our dates and locations for July listed on the website. Again, socialsecuritydinner.com. That's all the time we have for the program this week. Hope you got something you can use. We'll be back here again, same time next week. Hope you'll tune in.